practical, which are always elusive, but the most essential signs of what a city can be. Thank you very much.
Discussion to about 30 minutes and then go upstairs for coffee. And I'd like Charmaine to introduce the discussion, then open it up to the floor. Obviously, everyone, I hope, is aware that we can use the translation, simultaneous translation, when appropriate.
Well, we have heard five excellent presentations on three very interesting cases, but I'd like to simplify by just suggesting that we focus our discussions on the social versus the spatial, or people versus place. Since I'm a social scientist, I'll take the precedence by opening up discussion on issues that related to people, residents, the social aspects of the issues that have been raised. The three issues that really come to both of us as very significant in the context of all the three cities are the issues of in-migration, the impact on the city, the infrastructure, the social services, and also the economic issues of industrial restructuring between manufacturing and services, and also Jerry Frook's point about the important issues of political governance and financing, power sharing, decision-making processes. So I'd like our attention to start to focus on the issues that concern more on the social or people side of the urban issues. So the floor is open.
The technique should be to just put your hand up and if you have any comments to make. Saskia.
Please identify yourself and your institution.
Hello.
Hello? Yeah, it's on.
My name is James Farrer. I teach sociology at Sophia University in Tokyo, and I research on Shanghai, and I'm now at Fudan University as a visiting scholar. And my question regards the issue of preservation. I know many of the people who live in Shanghai are very interested in the preservation of the old city and the preservation of spaces like, and I guess many of you who are visiting here have seen Xintiandi. And I'm wondering if Xintiandi is really the model for what Shanghai is doing. And so I guess my question is to Professor Zheng Shiling about the concept of, I saw the big plan for Hengshan Lu and other areas. But when you look at Xintiandi, what you see is a kind of a shell of a neighborhood, and you have a preservation of physical space, but no preservation of social infrastructure, so that one is losing the surrounding, the community is disappearing or being moved away. And is there any, in the plans for preserving areas like around Hengshan Lu and Dulan Lu and these other areas that you pointed out, is there a plan for preserving any of the social aspects? So this relates to the question of place and society.
Thank you for your question. Xintiandi is at the very beginning for the preservation. The idea initiated in 1996. And the execution was since 1999. At that time, we have just worked out the preservation program, but not in detail. So the day before yesterday, during our visit to Xintiandi, I say Xintiandi is an American idea. According to European culture and the urban fabric, and under the Shanghainese context. This is the idea. But it has preserved just 4 hectares, but destroyed 1.2 square kilometers area. So it's a good example for a model for the preservation, but it's also a very bad model for the future development. So after Xintiandi, many new idea for other area for those kind of preservation. But today, as I just mentioned, next week we will finish all of the those 12 areas preservation program. So that will be settled down for the legislation. We have to preserve for each block and also the condition for the planning, its height, its function, and also the density. Thank you.
To give as many people a chance to speak, please keep your comments or questions as brief as possible. Saskia.
I would like to connect the very important points made by Professor Frug on the notion that the city should be located in a complex system that includes the national government, city government, and the citizenry, a very fuzzy but important notion, with the Shanghai situation. And I would really like to address my question not only to Professor Xiling Zheng, but also perhaps to Professor Zuo from the Academy, and perhaps there are other colleagues from Shanghai who could address it. And to keep it short, as I was just instructed, to focus on the citizenry. How are the citizenry in Shanghai emerging or not emerging as a political voice? And whom do they address? The city government or the national government? Are there different kinds of political questions that they are addressing to different instances of the government? I realize this is a bit of a complicated question, but perhaps we can begin to address the subject.
It looks like a question for Professor Zuo.
It's on? Yes? Okay. I think in early years of Shanghai's rebuild of the old residential areas, people were more the residents were more willing to such projects because they can improve their living space, the housing. Okay.
It's a bit difficult to hear.
In early years of the rebuild of the old residential areas of Shanghai, I think that the residents were more willing to move out because they can improve their housing, their living space, but not too far from the city center. But as the city is expanding, then the relocation will be farther and farther from the city center. And in the meantime, I think the housing in the city center are becoming more expensive. So people compare, what they get and what they lose. So there was some resistance to such relocation. I think they appeal to the local, to the district government, to the local, to the municipal government, and sometimes to the central government. And I think in the recent 2 years, the rise of the residents are more emphasized by different level of governments. So I think the relocation process slowed down in the recent 2 years. I think this is a very complicated situation. It will remain a challenge for future development of Shanghai. But I think Professor Fu, you mentioned we have to learn from other cities not to do something. I think this is maybe something we have to learn from because otherwise, you know, the old part of the city is disappearing too fast. Disappearing too fast. I think we have to learn not to do something. Thanks.
Can I just take the liberty of being the chair of identifying another prominent social scientist in the audience to maybe address that question? Professor Peng from Fudan University, would you be willing to make a quick comment on that? Please introduce yourself and your institution.
Yeah, okay. I'm a professor at Fudan University, working on social development and public policy issues. To reply to the Sassen's questions, I think that in China, basically, up to the moment, the urban development is the right or responsibility of city government, or they're under the very heavy pressure from the central government. In fact, Professor Zeng Sling talked about the population in Shanghai. At the moment, we have more than 17 million population as a long-term residents, and also we have the 4 million migrants. This kind of population will continue to grow. And also for the city government, now they're under the pressure from central government. The central government wants Shanghai to become even larger, to absorb more migrants into the city. Then for the local government, for the district government, now the district government would like the population in their district to become larger. Because in China, according to country regulation, the population size linked to your ability, your capacity to develop your housing estate or to develop this kind of industrial project. So with limited population, you can do very limited things. With a larger population, you can do more things. So at this moment, I think that for the Shanghai municipal government, they're under some pressure. On the one hand, from central government, ask them to absorb more people. They're under the pressure from the district government to get a much larger population in their district. Then regarding the rights of the individual residents, I think at this moment it's very limited, but now the government realizes when we develop the new city, we have to recognize the rights of the individual residents, rather than they just, in the past, they just become some kind of things, just the plan, some kind of things played by the planners. But now they should, their voice should be heard. So that's why, as Professor Zhuo said, in the last few years, the rights of the people, they are asked to move out. It's become a really big issue. So that's why the city government pay close attention to that and pay much higher compensation to these kind of people if they are going to out. But of course, now tomorrow we have a special session on this kind of community development, on the community committee in the local areas. In the past we have a homogeneous community structure. Now we have the head structure. These kind of things become largely diversified, this kind of community structure. So this respect to the individual people's rights in these communities. Thank you.
Does this work?
Yeah.
Yeah. I wanted to ask Professor Frug a question. Would part of your argument be that the building of iconic architecture, which is part of the sort of pursuit of globalization, has an anti-democratic effect? Something we might discuss.
So I thought that Dan Sujic's talk and my talk were identical. He was showing its physical form and I was showing its legal form. And there's two different things. One of it is that it has an anti-democratic effect. And the other thing is, if we had a popularly elected, contested election in Shanghai for the mayor of Shanghai, we have that already in New York and London. And the city itself does not have the power, and the people's relationship to the city, there's a lot of political structure that is not working to make more democratic the decision making about the built environment.
And yet, New York and London are equally in pursuit of the iconic.
Yes.
What I'm asking you is it this architecture itself which is disempowering to the populace?
Well, for those of us who aren't architects, it's a very odd thing that architects are working to build these famous solitary buildings as the idea of urbanism. It feels to me not in touch with the social and economic world in which they're locating these buildings. And you can go to many neighborhoods in London and New York and Shanghai and see that.
Professor Tu.
Hello. Yes. Tu Qi from Shanghai Academy of Social Sciences. My question to Professor Frey.
Can you speak closer and louder?
Okay, sure. My question is to Professor Frey. Hello?
Yeah,
okay, I shout. Anyway, the question is also to the words. I like your words. You mentioned about get things done and sometimes to prefer to not get things done. Then my question is how to keep the balance. Always this is very challenging thing. I still remember, I will raise a case. 2 years ago when I was in India, Delhi, they have their first metro line. And the first day I was there, I mean, the reporter that says like that metro line get done say like 2 year earlier. Why? Because the head of the construction team say give me the power, everything in my control, and I can get things done. And the reality is he gets things done 2 year earlier. But you know, like back to Shanghai. So far, I mean, Shanghai is definitely government. The government is definitely the body who really can get things done very efficient. But so far, I can say what we are doing, what we have done, is all majority things are good. But if we suppose we get something, do something wrong, then it can be also very efficient. Then my question is, basically, how to keep the balance?
It's a very profound question for every city that we're talking about. Sometimes the balance is so much more in building, and sometimes the balance is so much more in stopping. It's a very complicated thing. And one of the design questions that I think we have before us is designing city institutions trying to balance those two things, which is both a balance, which is Saskia's point, of citizen action and government officials, and a balance of local action and national interest. It's a design question. And I don't think New York and London have worked it out. I don't.
Tony Travers.
I'm Tony Travers from the London School of Economics. It's clear that already this last debate has further.
Hello. Hello.
Right. Tony Travers from the London School of Economics. The discussions in the last few minutes have suggested quite clearly that there is a tension between the iconic skyline building that cities clearly feel for global competition reasons a need to indulge in, and the street level democratic experience of the cities and the sort of day-to-day life of the things that people who live there and indeed who need to use them experience. So there is the conflict clearly between what the city looks like if you stand back and look at it as a skyline and what it is like to live in and to experience. Which is not, I'm afraid, what I was going to talk about. What I really wanted to do was to talk to Gerald Frug about the paradox of the contrast between the economic importance of cities to their countries, but then the fear that this induces in upper levels of government that then will not give the cities the autonomy or not sufficient autonomy to deliver in a way that their citizens would locally desire. So am I right in thinking that there is a sort of paradox there, that there's an economic importance which national governments recognize, but they're not prepared then to leave the cities with the autonomy they would need fully and effectively to develop themselves?
Yeah, I think there's that paradox. But to go back to your first point, the cities building this kind of building is designed to have an impact on the social and economic development. It moves people around. It changes the nature of the city. It fosters inequality. It's not an accidental byproduct. We're trying to create a particular type of city, and we're working very hard to do it. And the idea of the modern as being enshrined in a skyscraper is part of it. So I think we're fighting about the definition of the future and of modernism and about the ability of the cities to define it. It's true. The national governments are pushing economic development. From the city's point of view, they should say, okay, now let's talk about what that would look like as a physical matter, as a social matter, as an economic matter, as a political matter. We can design many kinds of economic development.
Put the microphone very close to you.
It is very close, oh yes. I yield to no one in my suspicion of architects and architecture. However, I think it's possible to kind of focus too much of our concerns about the way that the world is being commodified and consumerized on the architect's vision, and especially the vision of those computer rendering artists who create these glittering skylines that almost don't even need to be built. The idea of architecture, I think, is what gives it its power, but also its weakness, is that possibility of envisioning something before it's happened. And that power is what has given architecture that appeal to regimes or individuals of all kinds throughout history. I mentioned Siena and its city tower, 250 feet high, as a gesture towards Florence. This is part of the DNA of city building, which goes back to the earliest times. And no matter how sophisticated and how open we are to the needs and demands, architecture has always been.
At this point, I'd like to invite Professor Zhu Dajian from Tongji University maybe to make a comment, perhaps with a reference also to the other presenters, so we don't just all focus on Jerry.
Wait. 这个我想用中文讲的稍微深一点啊，对不起，听了上午的这个讲话，我感到因为沙顺教授是研究全球城市的这个 leading professor， 我觉得我们现在可能通过这样一些讨论啊，对全球城市内涵还可以深化一下。以往的全球城市都是经济导向，引进外资、引进跨国公司，变成衡量全球城市的一个 重要的标准。刚才许多教授都讲了，我觉得现在有一个悖论。一方面，这个是大家希望把城市建设，特别是像上海、伦敦、纽约变成全球城市，但是另外一方面，这样一些城市呢，现实上都不是 livable city。我曾经在芝加哥会议上讲到，现在有一个很重要的悖论，像纽约这样城市，你问它，它是全球城市的数一数二的，但是你问它是最适于居住的吗？ 也许它不属于这个行列，但是反过来，我们去举一点最适宜居住的城市，可能就没有我们今天讨论这样城市的行列。这是一个很严峻的学术挑战。也许沙顺教授可以修改一下、深化一下它的全球城市的含义，怎么样把 livable 跟这个经济上的 globalization 结合起来？我觉得这是我们可以深化的一个。那么在这个上面，我还想讲的第二点呢。 就是我们的城市为什么会觉得全球经济竞争的城市呢？它是个企业导向的城市，政府官员把所有的优惠政策都是希望把企业、大企业引进来，至于这些企业能不能为当地人服务，是没有考虑到的。我们在陆家嘴已经看到了这样现象，大家可以看到陆家嘴高楼大厦上面像一个曼哈顿。 但是你在这个走道上去走一走，你感到很不人性化。 所以这是一个形态跟社会问题的一个现实的挑战。这个我觉得，但是如果往生理想一想，如果我们把城市战略走向一个以人为导向的战略，也许你也可以成为一个全球城市。因为以前是企业跟着地方走，别人的是 follow location， 现在是 talent follow location， 然后别人的是 follow talent， follow skill people。 所以我想这样一个战略应该成为一个新的全球城市的发展战略。这是我想要评论第二个观点。第三个观点，如果从这里边倒下去，那么我们的城市的物质形态呢就会不一样了。比如说大家也看了上海许多标志性的东西，福禄格教授来之前跟我在哈佛我们吃了一顿中饭，讨论得很深。福禄格教授还有很多思想，刚才我们车上他也讲了，他说越是大官员越是想让自己的政绩让人家看到，他就越需要造更大的项目，而一般的他小项目是人家看不到的，这是一个真理。那么但是我们想一想，许多大剧院大运动场，一个普通市民一年里面去了几次？一次就不去了。许多投资都花在这上面。如果是你以人为导向的城市，那么我们会需要建造更多适宜人居住的更加可进入的 amenity， 包括物质的、环境的、人文的，这是以人为本城市。 OK， 那么这样呢更多的城市也会进来了。所以我想我就谈这样三个观点，我觉得可以把这个问题这个是往下走一走。谢谢大家。
Saskia, do you want to respond briefly and then Anthony Mayer?
I will address some of these issues in tomorrow, but just very quickly to respond. I think you're absolutely right that there is a way in which the global city can be thought of as also a people's environment where mixity and difference and immigrants and old-time residents, etc., can sort of feel that this is also their city. So I would say that the internationalism of business is in a way, and we see that in all these cities, paralleled by an internationalism of people. But the business internationalism has simply been the dominant form, and we have neglected working with the mix of talents, not just designated talents, that entails. So I like it. But I will return to some of this when I discuss tomorrow.
Anthony Mayer? You're getting excited.
I would agree with Professor Frug that city development is something that is done to people, and that iconic architecture is fundamentally undemocratic. I am quite relaxed about this. If you'd left it to the people living where Canary Wharf was, it would still be a derelict dock with lots of people dressed in nice pearly suits, eating cockles and mussels and singing local Cockney songs. If you left it to the people of London to decide whether or not to pay for Crossrail, I have every certainty they would say no, because a majority of them will never use it. If you left it to the people of Paris as to whether or not Notre Dame should have been built, I doubt that they would have agreed. Let us celebrate the fact that global cities need iconic building, need dynamism and growth. Where I think it goes wrong, getting back to the original statement about the distinction between object and process, is too many of us, having built the object, then run away from it. My problem with Canary Wharf is that having built it, nobody who lives locally works in it. Can we not actually enrich those local communities by having that facility? We fail. In terms of something like Crossrail, yes, let us connect the City of London with Heathrow, but let us extend that railway line into some of the poorest parts of London, to allow the poor people in London to get to the city of London where the jobs are. Bottom line, let us not be hypocritical. Iconic buildings, city development, yes, the providers probably have got the adventure, but let us not, having done it, then forget the process aspect involving communities in those new facilities.
Okay, we have maybe time just for entering a slightly different subject. Perhaps Gitam Tiwari was waiting to speak. Zeng Shiling, I would like to go back to you about the issue of preservation at the end.
Statement of the other side. And I'm delighted to have it. So I think it's the issue about the relationship between the decision makers and the people. And as you said, really, the balance between them. We're not talking about the option between no Canary Wharf and leave it as it is. And Canary Wharf, which you yourself had this critique of how it is, it's the idea of putting the two processes together as a design matter. So I think I welcome the remark very much, actually.
Item. It should be on, just bring it very close.
Hello? Yeah. I'm Gigi from IIT Delhi. I thought of my question right in the beginning. Since then, so many points have been raised. But let me link, because I think the question is still relevant. And my question was really inspired by Professor Frug's speech, where he mentioned that what cities look like if we think about a finance-oriented city versus floating population, what you called at that time. And then if I start thinking about all megacities, especially in the south, especially when we talk about Asian megacities, of India, China, and Latin America. I think whether we call them floating population or informal sector or immigrants, there is a very close relationship between the growth of city itself and these people. So it is not a question of merely giving them voices when we are developing cities and asking them, where would you like to live? Where would you like to be relocated? In fact, as planners, we have to understand what is the close symbiotic relationship between this section and the formal sector that we keep planning, the symbols that we talk about, and we saw several pictures of it. Those symbols in these cities cannot exist without the other section. So I think as formal planners, I would like to hear and more analysis, where what is our understanding? How are we failing in integrating this? When we develop our indicators, where are we failing? We really haven't come up with that. So it's not just merely giving them power to bring their voices in asking where would you like to live, but I think it is going many steps beyond that. And understanding the symbols cannot happen without this. So anyone who wants to respond.
The issue is that, of course, it's just a question at the moment of time, but these are big questions which I hope absolutely throughout the next 2 days we are going to address. There are the four individual sessions will certainly deal with this, but I mean, we are touching upon an issue of governance and who is one governing for, which will be the central theme of a discussion later today. So I hope a lot of these questions can be picked up. Could I ask Zeng Shiling if you wanted to just comment on some of these issues and then close the session for the morning?
For the historical preservation, it's very difficult for Shanghai. For those magnificent buildings, no doubt, many enterprises and the bank corporations, they will preserve it very good, but mostly for the housing. Because this problem is not today's problem. Already since maybe 100 years, many people live in a very small house. During the Second World War, many people came from the Chinese territory into the French concession and international settlements. And one very good house for one family would leave three or four families. And today, it leaves for even six or seven families. So we have to cut down the density. It's very difficult. And those buildings, it was the product of the real estate system during the history in the French concession or international settlements. At that time, the quality not very good. Today, the condition for living is also still very bad. So we are facing big argument. Somebody for 20 years ago, they thought this is a backward. We have to demolish all of those, and instead we have to replace them with high-rise buildings. But today, the municipality government has recognized this problem. And we have to have mutual consciousness for the preservation. It's a part of history, it's part of culture. For the Expo 2010, it's also very important for the reurbanization. It's our life quality and also our lifestyle. So today we are executing the most strict preservation process for the historic preservation. The things will get better and better in comparison to 20 years ago and 10 years ago. Now the situation is better, but we still need more investment and also more good developer and also good government officials to realize this kind of idea. Thank you.
Well, Ricky and I to thank all the presenters and all the participants and everyone else. We'll take a 10-minute coffee break and then we'll resume the next session.